Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the August 17th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim. I'm president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bunsen right across the table here. He's an economist, an author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bunsen Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, my friend?
I am good. You'll be delighted to know that I won't go deep into the history, but I just wanted to note that 100 years ago this month, in 1922, the last California grizzly bear was shot and killed in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains in Fresno County.
And there's no more grizzly bears?
No more California grizzlies. There's some taxonomical argumentation and disputation about the varieties of bears, but there is a California grizzly bear. It's gone.
We made it extinct.
There are about 10,000.
I thought we were against doing that. What's the rule on it?
This is in 1922, before there was
Back then, if an animal was going around killing people, then we could make it extinct?
Yeah, or killing your cattle, which was often the case. I mean, these bears are massive.
We should have done that with jihadists.
That would have been good.
Saved us a lot of pain and misery.
They're covered by the endangered species.
So California grizzlies are no more, but Nevada grizzlies still exist.
If there is such a thing, sure. Yeah, there must be.
Or just American grizzlies. There's still grizzly bears.
There's grizzly bears, yeah.
I've seen them in Yellowstone.
Yes, there are grizzlies. The California grizzly was a distinct subspecies.
Was it nastier than a regular grizzly?
I don't know about that. That's a great question. I'll have to start to look into this.
What if it turns out that there's the grizzly bear, and then the California grizzly is the same as the grizzly bear, uh-huh, except for there's more tax regulation and a much shorter work week and an obsession with weather
and performs abortions?
Yeah.
No, there were about 10,000 of them by some measures I've seen when the first Spaniards arrived, and there were these awful 19th century things like the bear and bull fights. You probably heard about these things where they would put the two of them together and people would place wagers. I remember in graduate school, I actually learned and then had to unlearn that Horace Greeley apparently saw one of these things out here, you know, the Go West Young Man guy, and declared that, this was really the stock market. This is how the stock market worked, bears and bulls. But apparently bear fights and bull fights precede that as metaphors for the marketplace. But anyway, these bears gone, it lives, you know, the California grizzly lives on the California bear flag. And
So today, if there was still some California grizzlies and there was some pretty nasty stuff going on, my understanding is grizzly bears are not good.
Well, they're very aggressive.
And real capable.
Yes.
Like fast as cheetahs and strong as dinosaurs.
They can be, you know, somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 pounds. So they're big animals and they're super fast. The Spaniards.
1,000 pounds and fast is just, that's just frightening to think.
It's what offensive linemen are becoming in football, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yes, we will.
Maybe. So, David, we have a lot to get to. And I don't just say that the way that I normally do. It's just overwhelming. I trimmed this down, you'll be glad to know, from about 30 entries to just a few. I want to start with Mark Andreessen, and Andreessen Horowitz, the company Andreessen Horowitz, you know infinitely more about these guys, but made this fascinating announcement that they were moving their headquarters to the cloud. And they are a Silicon Valley firm, Menlo Park, to be more precise. Andreessen lives in Atherton, which will be in California, which will become material here in a moment. But there were some of my favorite lines in this Wall Street Journal piece from this company, because it just sounded so classically Silicon Valley, the language of, you know, like almost shedding gravity. The company is going to open kind of satellite offices around the country. And it's in part because the company just says, like, look, man, they learned during the pandemic they did not have to be locked down in California, that once they allowed workers to go wherever they wanted, they still had the same functionality. And my favorite bit here is that Mr. Horowitz, this is from the Wall Street Journal story, Mr. Horowitz said the firm's new operating model means that it will work mostly virtually, but will continue to have physical offices to, quote, develop our culture, help entrepreneurs, and build relationships. So far, so good. The story ends with this line from Mr. Horowitz, quote, "The firm is now virtual, but can materialize physically on command." Mm. Sounds like a ghost, something in Star Trek. You know, we can materialize, uncloak. We will materialize on command. I just see Mr. Burns in The Simpsons dropping a smoke bomb and thinking he's disappeared. But anyway, there it is. Andreessen moving headquarters to the cloud, done with California. And it's interesting to me because this...
Now, of course, just so we're clear, you don't get to file a tax return in the cloud. Okay? So
they got to be somewhere.
They do have to be somewhere. And the more interesting... If their point they're making is we're going to decentralize a lot of efforts using digital technology and then operate multiple offices. So like my own firm, for example, we now have offices, physical actual offices in Oregon, in New York, in Minnesota, in Tennessee, and California. But our primary operating places are split between California and New York, because that's where the operation of the company is. And because it's service business, we have to allocate profits to pro rata to where they're generated. So it's a little more complicated. But my point being, you don't get to like, I want to know where they're going to be listing their state tax return. Hmm. Where they're going to be filing their state tax return. My suspicion is they'll have to be doing them, and probably already are now, in a lot of different places where they do business for similar reasons to what I just said. But if it turns out, no, we're actually kind of using the Miami thing. We're not just opening an office in Miami. That's going to be the new hub, and we're going to call it the cloud, and then we're diminishing California, and yes, there is a tax play here. That's probably where I suspect this is going.
Walk me through the other big headline regarding Andreessen.
About the WeWork Horowitz thing?
Yeah. Here's the headline. Mark Andreessen, a housing foe, and Atherton invests in WeWork CEO's startup aiming to help renters. Now, there's a lot to unpack just in the headline, but Andreessen and his wife apparently are opponents of an attempt in Atherton to create higher density housing apartments. And he and his wife contributed to the debate there in Atherton by saying that, in fact, they did not want, let me see if I can find the great quote here. He keeps talking about the housing crisis as a reason that he wants to get involved with the former head of WeWork. I swear we're coming back to that. But that in Atherton, he and his wife were foes of more apartments. They emailed the city and said, please immediately remove all multifamily overlay zoning projects from the housing element, which will be submitted to the state in July. They will massively decrease our home values, the quality of life of ourselves and our neighbors, and immensely increase the noise pollution. So, he's all for density, just not where he lives. And, you know, that's, I would argue to some extent, that's the prerogative of local government, so long as they don't trample on the property rights of others. And like many cities in California, Atherton is under the pressure from the state government, from Sacramento, to just like open up. You see this all over the state, these efforts by state legislators to, quote unquote, cure the housing crisis by blaming locals for having created it. We saw this last week when we talked about San Francisco. And the state investigation there of a failure to really build housing. But there's just so much here. I want to put the Atherton thing aside because I think that's just the San Francisco Chronicle trolling and saying, look, he's a bad guy. He's a hypocrite. I'm much more interested in this big play that he's making. He and his firm are making in the ex-WeWorks guy. Maybe you can start by just giving us background. Who is the WeWorks guy? I only know him from the documentary my wife reports to me. In which he apparently walked away from this massive kind of like Silicon Valley style effort.
Walked away.
Did he run?
No, he was beat out. I mean, they threw him out in one of the most high profile, humiliating firings in finance history. So there is a significant and a pretty good documentary on Hulu and a number of the streaming things, but then there was a like 6-part or 8-part miniseries made where Anne Hathaway played Adam Newman's wife, and what was it? Jared Leto played Adam Newman. It was really good, really well done. Okay, this guy is the biggest ass clown I've ever seen in my life.
And this is Adam Newman.
Yes,
his name. Yeah.
And so he just is as charismatic. He's a cult leader, but a really good one. And I wrote an article for National Review, and if you're able to put in the show notes, Will, I'd love for you to. But I wrote an article about what the failure WeWork said about just a state of business, state of culture, state of society, state of ESG, this sort of modern religious thing that, oh, who needs prophets? You know, we're just all one with the world and we're investing in social consciousness. It's like, yeah, no, actually need revenues. it's real adorable. And at the same time, there was a Showtime miniseries that kind of got into the pathology that had taken place at Uber. And then what was the third
there
one?
Was the
oh,
one?
And then there was the Theranos gal that was on Hulu. Yeah. And so I kind of used a sort of hybrid of these three high profile stories. But the thing about Adam Neumann was he was just really, really good at raising money and getting like guys like the CEO at SoftBank had given him $4 or $5 billion, and they just burned through the money. They burned through hundreds of millions a month, and then they wanted to go out to Wall Street at a $62 billion valuation, and they couldn't sell anything at a $10 billion.
And the business was supposed to be setting up kind of community work centers.
Okay, well, listen, you're begging the question. I don't know what a community work center is. It's an office.
Yeah.
Okay. So right. So then they were going to have much better furniture.
It
was
like
temporary office. Primarily, yeah. If we're being honest, it's a place for a lot of unemployed people to go to work. Okay? I'm just saying, it's people looking for jobs or they're kind of like freelance. And now, were there really successful graphic designers and CPAs and architects and coders and programmers? Maybe. But, you know, I think it was just people going, they get their laptop, they're kind of messing around. Then they had beer and weed and parties, and this was the whole thing, right? And that was the culture of it. And they created some beautiful office lobbies and all this stuff. So it was basically lease for X long term and lease out for more than X short term. Mm. And it was incredibly capital intensive, and it was and there's tons of these short-term office rental models over the years. I used one when I left Morgan Stanley called Regis that we were using to get set up. I think they've gone bankrupt like twice and come back around. But WeWork had some sex appeal to it. Mm-hmm. It was fashionable. It was hip. It was young, catered to kind of cooler people. But it was just a money-losing debacle. And this is all before COVID.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
Finally, the board comes in and realizes this guy's just a clown, and he was doing self-dealing, and he was a psychopath. They threw him out, and then COVID happened, and everything got put on hold. And then they went public through a SPAC at like a $4 billion market cap right now. The SoftBank people invested at a $47 billion cap. So someone wrote down 90% of a multi-billion dollar investment. Neumann walked away with about $1 billion. He was able to get out. So now he started this new thing called Flow. And I just want to read you the language to tell you, see if any of this sounds familiar. For anyone who followed WeWork, it was always, we are not an office rental company. We're not a real estate company. We are literally a social consciousness company, and we are uniting the world. And I say, look, I really want to unite the world. Like, now my preference, I'd like to unite around faith and family they were uniting it, just people coming to the office and getting drunk together. Look, you can do that without a lease.
That's right. Go to the bar.
Lynch's,
yeah, bring it
right at 28th Street on the peninsula. And it's frankly, I like that aesthetic better. You know what I mean? The food is fine, I guess. I don't know. So it was just the silliest darn thing I've ever seen. And some grown-ups in Silicon Valley and grown-ups in Wall Street finally just started hammering it. And Scott Galloway went to the Wall Street Journal and just said, how long are we going to entertain this notion of this business model? It was a joke. So here's what he's saying with Flow, that what they are trying to do is address the inability for renters to own equity in their homes and the lack of social bonding between neighbors. And that, okay, so let me stop there. First of all, is it a tautology that renters don't own equity in their homes?
It is. And I don't, that's what I don't understand.
You know what else I don't own equity in?
Tell me.
Your home. What the hell does that mean? Since when is it a problem? Like, hey, I would like to eat my lunch right now, but I got to be honest. I don't think it's fair that I don't own any of this restaurant. And I'm going to sit here. I'm going to eat this lunch that I'm paying for, but I'm not going to own any of it. And I don't feel that's
not right. Really creating value long term.
So there's absolutely no problem with renters not owning equity. That's what a renter does is not have equity. What does a renter get in exchange for not having equity?
A place to live.
They get a place to live. They get to avoid the property taxes. Mm-hmm. They get to avoid some of the insurance and maintenance costs.
Some of them, you know.
They get flexibility. They don't have to make a down payment. So that's a decision. And then what a person who chooses to own gets is all those extra expenses and risks, but then they also get to build equity. So this is just market transaction 101, easiest stuff in the world. The lack of social bonding, though, I'm sorry. Are we dealing with great social bonding amongst all the people who own homes together? Because the fact of the matter is, this is the defining characteristic of suburbia right now, is that a bunch of homeowners get together, park their car in their garage, and don't say a damn word to one another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's why I moved out of Dover Shores in Newport Beach. I lived there we built our dream house there. It was beautiful. Looked out over Back Bay. Brand new home that was lovely. And when did we, let's see, we made it 4 years there.
Mm.
And I'm telling you, we didn't talk to a neighbor.
Mm.
And it just wasn't that community, you know, that we wanted to have. And now, you know, we live somewhere else still in Newport Beach, and it's a bit different the way the community is set up. But my point is, suburbia, this is a thing that people have been writing about for decades now.
Yeah.
It's a hallmark of postmodernism is what it is. It has nothing to do with renters. In New York City, I'll tell you right now, a bunch of renters of condos and apartments have just as much social bonding as people who own co-ops in Upper East Side. I mean, you're in community together because you live together
in
high density living that is so problematic to these people.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what it is Flo is looking to do, but then when I see what they're actually doing, they're buying apartment buildings.
Yeah.
Okay. It just sounds, that's what I was going to ask.
So that's, this is the part
it's where. It's just WeWork, right? But except for it's apartments.
Right. But all it is you, at the end of the day, it's a business model. You go in and you're making a capital investment. It looks like they bought 4,000 apartments in Miami, hot. Atlanta, pretty hot. Nashville, very hot. Fort Lauderdale, hot. Okay, so they're doing what anyone wants to do. They're going and buying apartment buildings in cities that a lot of people want to move to that are really popular right now.
Mm-hmm.
Attractive job market, young demographic, reasonably close to dining and culture and things like that. Good. But then what is going to be different? Come to our place and we're going to provide you social bonding?
Right.
Come on.
Well, here's the line. This is what I wanted to ask you about, because I just didn't understand how this really differs dramatically from the business model of WeWorks. And it sounds like the same thing, but just for residential. And it says here, it's an effort to create, quote, a community-driven, experience-centric service with the latest technology in a way that has never been done before, to create a system where renters receive the benefits of owners. And they don't go on to explain what these benefits are and how they would be transferred to people who rent. And you just did a nice job of delineating those.
I don't know what it means. If it means equity, like we're going to take the risk, the investors are taking the risk of it all, and we're going to give the equity to renters, then that's a bad investment. But it doesn't mean that. They're full of it. So if it means that, like, no, it's you're renting, but we're going to let you have a say in the paintings and stuff like that, well, great. Okay. Come.
So
you can pick the colors.
So what would you guess Andreessen Horowitz is doing? They wrote a check here, it says,
$350. Well, first of all, they're venture capital people. They're not private equity. They're not supposed to make money on that many of their investments. They, on average, you lose on about 7.8 out of 10 investments. The whole business model of venture capital is to win, to get 10x on one or two investments that then allow you to suffer some losses. So $350 million is not a lot of money. It's not their money. Some of it is. They're GPs in this endeavor, but there's a lot of investor capital that comes into it. They don't want to lose money, but I'm saying the VC world is supposed to throw flyers. And I think that the Silicon Valley cult of this stuff does generally buy into a lot of the rhetoric. I'm sure that Newman's written a better business plan this time around than WeWork. Like WeWork, he was just dealing with some of the most naive, gullible, desperate FOMO people. They were all afraid of missing out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure they've kind of matured the pro forma a little bit, if you will. But as far, you know, it's possible Andreessen believes some of this stuff. He's a reasonably bright guy. There's a lot I like about him in his criticism of the woke left. Horowitz is the grown-up in the room, though. Horowitz is a very disciplined investor. You know, it's David's son.
I didn't know that.
Not our friend David Horowitz. The David Horowitz of the Freedom Center.
Oh, my gosh. The red diaper baby David.
full radical left.
Yeah.
Ben is David's son.
Oh, my gosh. Look at that. Well, you know, maybe those prophets will materialize on command just like the, yeah. Hey, another big news. The Gascon recall effort apparently has failed, according to the L.A. County Registrar. They went through and... here's where the controversy is. It was rejected. The recall signatures did not qualify at a level sufficient to actually move it on to November. But now there's controversy about why the disqualification of signatures during this verification process in LA County was unprecedentedly high. So they needed roughly 750. What did they need here? They needed like 700,000 signatures. They surpassed that level pretty dramatically, and about 200,000 signatures, or 27%, the highest level ever, were disqualified. And so naturally, folks who are on the recall side, who really wanted this thing, are saying, you know, they're calling shenanigans. They're saying, like, there's just something wrong here. One of my staffers, Alex, thank you, Alex, for this work, went through and checked it out, and the LA count last during the Newsom recall, signatures were disqualified in LA County at a far lower level. During the recall election, they had provisional ballots coming in with signatures and that sort of thing, and mail-in ballots, and they disqualified signatures at about a 10% lower rate, so about 18% versus 27%. So it's a disappointing end to what looked like an interesting deal for the voters of LA, who are pretty outraged. But, you know, I think you've said this before.
And but again, I mean, when you look at the 190,000 that they disqualified, 88,000 were people not registered.
That's what they, right.
Well, and so that's pretty cut and dry.
That would seem to be pretty cut and dry. It's, and so when you look at,
and then 44,000 were duplicates.
That's right.
I mean, if it, so like, I see that there are 5,300 of an address signature thing, and so there's some small ball stuff on some others.
Yes.
But the low hanging fruit, 120,000, 70% of them, that seems like it's pretty obvious.
Well, and the important thing here, yes, so there will be more revealed on this. I know I talked to a few reporters out there who are investigative reporters, more familiar with this than I am, and they're looking really deeply into this to see, like, why the variance, given that, you know, the firms behind gathering the signatures, the organizations behind that effort, are pretty polished and pretty sophisticated. But this, you know, these results would suggest somebody screwed up somewhere, whether it's the county and its registrar, or it's actually the signature gatherers, which looks more likely.
Well, there's another screw up.
What's that?
Just doing it to begin with.
That's what I was going to say.
Recall them on election day, my friends.
Right. And this is part of the problem with these recalls. It is so expensive in California. Never, you know, LA.
Expensive with money.
Yes.
What about time?
And time.
And this, energy.
Yes. So all of, you know, even the Newsom recall, which God bless the people who pushed that. I get it. I was one of the early opt-outs on that campaign because I said, look, we've only got a couple of years to raise enough cash to beat Newsom at the polls in 2022. And yet they went ahead, they raised a bunch of dough, and they worked very, very hard to get the recall qualified, and then got their butts handed to them. And again, I do not mean to admonish them. Reasonable people can disagree on this. But on principle, you know, your take, my take is you don't need a recall unless there is a clear and present danger of, you know, I don't know, violence and total meltdown.
We should make that illegal.
The recall?
We should make violence and chaotic cultural meltdown illegal, so we don't have to do a recall.
Yeah. And in fairness, the folks who are backing the recall against Gascon, against Boudin, against Newsom would argue that there is a clear and present danger. Clearly with Gascon, you've got people being, you know, let back out onto the streets who are violent predators, and they go back out and commit mayhem. That's a clear and present danger, arguably. But still, the effort to run a recall versus just gather your forces to blow this guy out of the race the next time when he's up for re-election. Gascon himself said that my stances are well known during the campaign, and the voters, you know, they knew it. They knew what they were getting when they got me. This is not a surprise. I didn't do a bait and switch. And he's right about that.
Pretty much he is.
Yeah. So I say the voters got what they wanted, and it's not even clear that LA County voters are ready to boot a guy like Gascon. You know, he represents that powerful impulse in LA. Rick Reif and I talked about this last week, about just that deep desire in LA to be more virtuous than others. And it is so powerful that, you know, it's arguable it's crazier than San Francisco in many respects. I wanted to use your leverage your expertise for our next story here on mask mandates. We now have a document revealed by the Southern California News Group. That's the LA Daily News, the Orange County Register, and a bunch of affiliates around Southern California. They Public Records Act requested, that's PRA in the business. They did a public records request for a letter from doctors at USC and UCLA to the Department of Public Health. Which they sent, the doctors wrote in February saying, look, man, the county should end its mask mandate. Here's a quote from the story. The county should end the mask mandate that was in effect past winter. That is winter of 2021, early 2022. They claim the policy did not work. So they say the after the mask mandates were imposed, transmission of COVID-19 not only didn't slow down, it actually increased. The LA County Department of Public Health, of course, under Barbara Ferrer, fought back and said, you know, no, this stuff's really important, and even if it saves one life. So it's fascinating because, you know, all of this
I
stuff.
I still love that. Every time I hear it, you know, if something saves one life, like, there's obviously in the political realm and talking about public policy, something so stupid about that because of lack of trade-offs and what does that mean? Like, right. You know, you can save a million lives if you ban automobiles. And
there you go.
But I just always loved Dennis Miller's stand-up where he had a bit where he goes, I'm telling you, if I can just make an impact in one person's life, I got to aim higher. It's not very many.
Knowing Miller, I thought he was going to say, if I could just make an impact on one person's life, I'd kill 10 others.
Yeah. No. But I think that this stuff, you finish.
Well, I'm so frustrated because all of this evidence was clear when you and I first started talking about COVID. It was very clear who was catching and getting the disease and transmitting it, who was being hospitalized, who was dying. We knew this. We were talking about it. You were writing about this every day, I want to remind our listeners. And the numbers are very clear then. They're very clear now. Masks don't do a lot, especially if you have underlying comorbidities or you're just old, you know? Weight and other underlying comorbidities and age are the primary indicators of a real problem. And so you mask up the whole population and shut everything down. And I remember when the Orange County...
By the way, the shutdowns and the masks are two totally different things to me. But the thing about the masks is it's absolutely true what you just said. They didn't do anything really and whatnot. The reason it became so toxic, like I just sort of wonder... If somehow all of us had figured out, like, come on, this is a little silly, if we could have just sort of not said anything for like a month, mm-hmm. would the left, because there's no doubt in my mind that for over a year, pretty much about 18 months of vigilant mask religiosity and mm-hmm. Phariseeism, it was driven by the left refusing to give up once it was clear the right didn't like masks.
Right. Yeah.
And it became like sacramental to these people.
Sure.
And if like the right kind of was like, this is stupid, but don't say anything, I think the left would have just been like, yeah, okay, this is dumb. Yeah. But once it became in that polarization, the genie got out of the bottle and then it was no going back.
It's possible, but you know, I went up to L.A. You know, you and I are down here in Orange County. I went up to L.A. a number of times. I have a son and daughter-in-law who live up there. My wife and I do. And so, you know, you visit up there and everybody's wearing masks in their cars, on the streets, in the restaurants, everywhere, you know, the restaurants that are open. And so you got to go along with it for that month.
But that's the Phariseeism.
Yeah, but I'm talking about your hypothetical is interesting, but it would have required people to, you know, those of us who think masks are ridiculous to go ahead and wear them. And I did.
Yeah, you know? No, yeah, you're right. And most of us did as well during that initial period, like in June, July of 2020. But like the CDC came out and it took them a year too long. They came out and said, you don't need to wear masks outdoors. And then there was a report where they said less than 10% of people got COVID outside. And the New York Times took the study from Denmark and said, you mean zero? Because that is less than 10%, you freaking liars. And it was zero. And so I thought, okay, finally, at least no one in New York's going to be wearing a mask outside anymore. And people still did.
They still, yeah.
And it went down and down. And here's the thing. Gen Xers and even a lot of older people, I noticed, like, kind of the just like tough New York grit people, they stopped doing it. Young people in Upper West Side, they'd go out to the bars. These young wokey woke liberals had to wear their masks, and it was like it became just a total social symbol. It had nothing to do with public health.
And
I just wonder, I thought back, like, how could we have done it different? And probably there's nothing.
Right.
But I can daydream.
Well, and I remember I wrote the white paper that the Orange County Board of Education relied on. And when I say white paper, let me make it really clear. I'm a reporter by training. All I did was I looked at all the medical reports out there, you know, American Academy of Pediatrics, National Institutes of Health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I gathered the evidence together. I didn't claim any originality in the findings. I just put them together and said, here's what we know. And among the things we know is, you know, kids under 18 do not catch, transmit, or get hospitalized or die from this disease. That's the evidence it's in. That was it. I wrote that in April and May of 2020. When the report came out and the Board of Education voted to approve it with some of their own amendments, they said, okay, so we don't need our kids to mask up. Well, the LA Times just went hysterical. You know, they wrote, I think, like three separate stories in about a week talking about this right-wing putsch in Orange County that was going to kill kids because we denied COVID because we wouldn't force kids to wear masks. And the Board of Education just said, like, look, man, we see the evidence. We want kids back in schools. That's where they belong. And it was the LA Times saying, no, lock them up, lock them up, lock them up. And I was vilified in that. And
I think one of the arguments that the other side made, and I heard plenty of people on the right and everything, and at different points along the way, it may have had different levels of acceptability. I have really good conservative friends that felt this way. At one point, they thought, okay, I don't know, I don't feel that strongly about the mask, but I don't mind it, so it's okay. There wasn't a huge downside to it. I you know, my old story with the Department of Homeland Security and everything on the airplane. But, you know, okay, I don't necessarily agree, and I think it got to a point where all of us were just like, stop this BS. But with children, I think it was damaging, and I think we have all understated the damage. I don't think we've exaggerated for effect. I think it was child abuse.
Yeah.
The lack of social interaction and seeing facial expressions and that kind of prolonged period of being cut off from that dynamic developmentally and socially, I think is just inexcusable.
And now we see groups like the California Teachers Association really leveraging, you know, here's the abuser now leveraging the victims of their abuse by saying, oh, these poor kids who lost so much, we need more money. We need teachers to have more money because of learning loss. The union created the union learning loss and now benefits from it. It's an extraordinary malfeasance on their part. Speaking of malfeasances, let's turn to monkeypox. One of my staffers, Houston Reese, suggested that we change the Wiener Watch temporarily to Monkeypox Minute. And by the way, since you and I have last talked about monkeypox, Scott Wiener, Gavin Newsom named Scott Wiener to chair the State Commission on Monkeypox, which will, I hope, be the highest office to which Scott Wiener ever wins any kind of infamy. But the federal government has said that it will stretch the supply of monkeypox vaccines by simply basically using less of it per vaccine. The pro-hysteria people are saying, oh my God, this is outrageous. You know, you're only getting 20% of what you need. This can't be right. Scott Wiener said, honestly, it's a little bit like the Hunger Games, and it's heartbreaking. So, you know, this is, take it for what it's worth. It's federal government saying, like, look, you don't need 100% of this vaccine to actually cure the vaccine. And you know what? You also don't. What would really help even more is social distancing. You and I have talked about this ad nauseum, and it's just embarrassing to even have to think about. But this disease, again, to reiterate what I think everybody now knows, the reason Scott Wiener's so interested is because it hits his constituency of gay and lesbian people. Well, not lesbians. Not lesbians at all. I'm thinking, like,
I don't think it does.
I was thinking myself, what's LGBT? No, it's really just men. Gay men who have, you know, it's men who have sex with other men, whether, and whether they call themselves transgender or whatever. If you're a man and you have sex with another man during the monkeypox epidemic, there is a greater likelihood you're going to suffer from this illness. Don't do that. You and I, 2 weeks ago, I think it was, were talking about how, why is it left to us to defend gay people from, you know, this terrible disease? Well, Scott Wiener's out there saying, hey, what can you do? People going to have sex. Sexy people going to sex. So, speaking of monkeypox,
hey, is Scott Wiener a gay man?
Yes. Gay, childless, represents a city that has the highest number of childless households in of any major city in the U.S. Pretty busy with other things.
All right.
So, hey, Politico had an interesting story, which I want to reference here in part because it has so many echoes of the drip, drip, drip campaign against Kamala Harris by Democratic Party insiders. Now the target, of course, is Becerra. And if you read the Politico article, here's the headline, Becerra in the hot seat again over monkeypox response. He's again because he was in the hot seat during COVID. There are some insiders who want to blame Becerra for the faulty rollout of testing and vaccine under the Biden administration. Now they're blaming.
Who wants to blame that on Becerra?
These are Democratic insiders again, just as in the case of Kamala. So just to remind everybody, you know, Kamala Harris steps on every rake in the front yard every time she goes outside the White House or the Vice President's office. And you have speculated, I think, correctly or hypothesized that really all this information is coming from people who just do not want her running in 2024. If Biden steps aside and Kamala Harris runs, she's going to be a disaster for the party. I don't believe she'd get out of the primary. I think you probably agree on that. But you once hypothesized, and it has stayed with me, that all of this is coming from party insiders who just want to create a clear path for somebody like Gavin Newsom to run.
The only people in the Democratic Party establishment who don't like Kamala Harris are anyone associated with Biden, Obama, or Clinton. That's it. Everyone else loves her.
Yeah. And that leaves about the 8% that she got during the primaries. So in the case of Becerra, there's something similarly interesting at work. The article tries to argue without any pretense of neutrality.
I swear to God, he sounds like Trump. We don't control health in 50 states. We rely on partnership with them. The states need to work with us. I'm not disagreeing with what he's saying.
Right.
My point is, and I shouldn't say Trump. I mean, Trump administration people were saying this during COVID, that we respect the idea of individual state responses, and everyone went ballistic.
Right.
And that's who knew Becerra the Federalist here?
That's exactly what I have in my notes. It's that this is a remarkably Federalist understanding of how government ought to work, and Becerra is being beaten up by people who want to see the Biden. There are a couple of lines. High up in the story, the reporter at Politico says,
this is in Politico, okay? Conservatives who want to bash Becerra are writing in The Federalist, or they're writing it like Washington Examiner or Free Beacon. The liberals who want to bash Becerra go to Washington Post and Politico.
Right. Yes.
This is not coming from Becerra haters. This is an inside job.
Yes, exactly. And the reporter, you know, sort of like, there's a pretense of testing his hypothesis that Becerra's really screwed up the monkeypox vaccine rollout and response. But then he just goes on to state it as a fact, the reason that he screwed up this rollout. What can I give you, buddy? You need something?
No, I'm looking for my eye drops. I don't know if
I'm fine. But here's the line. The Biden administration would look, you know, if they follow Becerra's plan of a partnering, that's the way I would put it, and the Becerra's own staff have put it, that they want to partner with local government, with the states and locals, you know, the counties and cities, on the monkeypox response. And I think that's not only fair, it's constitutional. The reporter says the Biden administration would look like it was ducking responsibility for managing a growing health crisis. He goes on and on. He says on a press call with Becerra. Becerra sought to shift responsibility for the monkeypox response to the states. Now, that's precisely the argument of the Democratic Party insiders about Becerra.
Yeah, by the way, I'll shift it from the states to the bathhouses. Like,
yes.
I'll go real subsidiarity with this thing if you want.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, he sought to shift responsibility. That implies that the responsibility started with the federal government.
Yes.
What world are we living in?
Right.
Where somebody's personal behavior and personal health that comes from it, that we believe that starts, the premise begins at the single most distant bureaucratic entity you can imagine. I don't even understand what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
If they end up playing a role in certain elements, it's so far down the line, and at best case might involve some funding or something. But this idea that, like, oh, you're shifting. This is you. Like, Biden's supposed to wake up and, like, what do I do today about monkeypox?
Right.
Please don't do that.
Yeah.
And I don't want anyone to get monkeypox. I don't. I don't want anyone to get sick. I don't want them to die, especially any of that. But for God's sake, think about how you're going to avoid the Taliban from attacking us today. And think about what you're going to do to stop impediments to economic growth.
Yeah, supply chain.
Don't wake up thinking about... I think Becerra should become one of us.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
Lean into this all the way.
That was what the Politico story persuaded me. Not that he's a bad guy or that he's really in a hot seat, but that he's actually shockingly got a kind of 10th Amendment perspective on state responsibility.
Interestingly, I think you found the story yesterday.
The Politico story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As I was reading it, when you sent it today, a thing popped up that Rochelle Lewinsky, the head of CDC, has announced a full overhaul of the entire CDC department based on failures during the COVID moment. And immediately I thought, wow, is there going to be like a mea culpa? And of course, it came down to how it wasn't enough power with the feds. They needed more centralization and less decentralization. And then I thought, anyone writing a like what we could have done better piece from the Fauci, from NHS and CDC that doesn't start with their resignation, I'm not going to read it.
I love your thinking, man. Well, I'll send Javier a letter and invite him to come on the show. And
let me know how that goes.
And convert. Hey, I want to move
on. Tell
them
we're monkeypox free.
We're wearing our pants right now.
We got his memo.
Yeah.
And we said, you know what? He's not going to be there to help us, but we're going to deal with it.
That's right. Hey, this week is the final week of the legislative session. Friday is the deadline for the State House to submit all of its pending bills. You know, if they want to get them to the governor's desk, they've got till Friday to submit them. So it's kind of Bill-O-Rama time. And David, I wanted to go through a few of the bills that you and I have discussed over the last, since January 1st, certainly, and even before in some of these cases. And what was weird, I swear to you, I did not filter for Scott Wiener. He is responsible for a majority of these. So consider this your Wiener Watch plus, you know, monkeypox moment.
Also known as the weekly radio Free California podcast.
So let's start with Senate Bill 834. This is Scott Wiener. It's a bill that would strip. This is so dumb. And it's really, I mean, it's a desperate desire on the part of Democrats to just keep January 6th alive. Keep repeating the tragedy and every time you can. So one of them is the SB 834 by Scott Wiener. He proposes that the state would revoke tax exempt status for nonprofits, quote, engaged in insurrection-related offenses. And the terrifying thing about this, of course, as you and I've discussed, is that it is left up to the state to determine whether you are involved in insurrectionist adjacent activities. It would be very clear this is a criminal offense to engage in insurrection. So if your nonprofit's involved in it, you're already committing a crime. Right. And
like if you've gone to jail for insurrection, then you have to go to jail for insurrection.
Yeah. And you might have bigger problems than the nonprofit status of your 501c3 organization. So that's still in play. That's headed toward.
Is there an example? He can't put it in the name of his bill. What's an example of a 501c3 he's talking about?
Well,
I mean, there is a whole bunch of people that I believe should be in prison for a long time for what they did on January 6th.
Sure,
those that rioted and attacked security and broached the barriers to go inside. And the excuse of like, well, some of the Capitol Police weren't fighting us back.
Right.
I don't buy any of that. You know, all of this stuff, I'm fine. I don't think it's a huge number, but it's a number, and they're bad people, and they should go to jail. But what is he talking about? 501c3s? Who? Like right now, I could think of some organizations that would put out stuff about voter fraud that I would disagree with.
Right.
They would be five nonprofits that would say they think the election was stolen.
Right.
And I think they're wrong.
Right.
But it's free speech.
Yes.
And it's not, it wasn't inciting insurrection.
But this bill is written in such, with such vagueness that it would allow the state to declare that that group, or even my group, California Policy Center, your group, David, California Policy Center, that our group is insurrectionist adjacent because we're supporting the right of parents to go into public meetings and protest the government's handling, you know, their school district's handling.
But what if someone who raises money to say, I want to raise money to fight against future voter fraud?
Yes, that's a problem.
Is that insurrectionist?
It could be construed that way. The problem here, is that it is a free speech infringement of paramount importance for us.
But is this going to pass?
It seems very likely to pass.
And the Supreme Court would throw it out in a second.
I believe it will be, yes.
By the way, Ninth Circuit will.
Yeah, even the Ninth Circuit will. I think you're right. And I'm going to skip down here, David, just to to a bill that's almost near the bottom here. It's SB 1100. Do you see that one? It guts the Brown Act, I put. This is by a state senator, Cortese, from San Jose.
I'm just curious. How come you skipped the other three?
Well, I'm going to come back to those.
Okay.
But this one is so related. You asked, you know, like, show me an example. Well, Cortese's bill, SB 1100, the headline in the LA Times story was, California lawmakers want to crack down on public meeting disruptions. What are the disruptions? People talking about they're spreading anti-vax myths or COVID myths, misinformation. That's the thing that they want to crack, you know, that the LA Times reporter cited as evidence of disruptive meetings where people would talk about these kinds of things. And so
willfully interrupting.
Right.
Impairing unfeasible orderly conduct and disruptive behavior, those things are not allowed now.
They're not allowed now. And so what are the reporters, if you go and look,
I'm going to make it illegal to do something illegal?
Well, that's what they claim, is that this is about people who willfully disrupt a public meeting.
So you don't need a bill. You already got it.
But the reason they want this bill is because it does two things. Number one, it basically criminalizes in a way. It uses free speech as a trigger to declare a willful disruption. So if you go in during your public comment period and you say, I think you know, the election of 2020 was stolen, or I doubt the authority of this board, or this board is mishandling my kids' education because of COVID, they can say, whoa, 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 over the line. We call this meeting adjourned, and we will now hold our own private meeting out of earshot of the public. The Brown Act in California, for those who don't know, probably a small number of people on this podcast, the Brown Act in California requires public meetings to be held in public. It does not allow more than it's typically in most places, no more than two members of any board to meet in private to discuss the public's business. This would say, nope, if you trigger by just waving a wand and saying, okay, this meeting's been disrupted, clear the audience, you can continue your meeting out of earshot of the public.
You like the Brown Act?
I do. I think it's ridiculous in some respects because I've been on the inside and I know how people get around it. But I think the idea, at least, is important. Go ahead and critique the Brown Act.
I think you're right. The idea is important. I just think you're right that it also just gets so
silly. It's like campaign contribution limits that cannot.
Find out, like, you're in a dinner and you have a conversation, people are elected, and then you find out later, like, they're, oh, we weren't supposed to talk about it.
Brown, right.
And you're like, okay.
Well, we used to have, when I was in
the only thing I want to say is I'm just bothered right now.
Yeah.
This story that you're quoting from the LA Times is talking about the substance of this bill,
right,
and what the pros and cons of it are. And as a general rule, if there's a bill saying it is illegal to violently interrupt a meeting, I don't want people who are critical of school trustees to threaten them.
Correct.
I don't want them to call them names.
Right.
I don't think that's a criminal offense. I think it's like, okay, your mic is cut off, get out of here, you're a nuisance. But the LA Times ran the story, it has the headline and the content, with a picture of a bunch of Trump people protesting outside Barbara Ferrer's house.
Right, right.
This has nothing to do with
the public
protest.
Meeting.
This is a very misleading photo.
It really is.
It bothers me.
Well, the whole bill is misleading. The story is misleading. The photo is misleading. And you and
I know what else I'm against, by the way, when we're talking about disruption and ad hominem, is Antifa.
Hmm.
How's that going?
Okay, so let's go back up to SB-866. That's
the Iraqi guy came and threw shoes at President Bush.
Yeah, remember that?
And everyone celebrated it. They liked it. And Paul Krugman threw a party and burned George Bush in effigy at his party. Lord. And everyone thought it was so great. Like, it's just such hypocrisy. But the problem is the right too much is like responding to the hypocrisy by tit for tat.
Yes.
Someone is just, come on, is there anyone out there who remembers just about doing the right thing?
I want us to win because we're better. That's all.
Well, they do it.
Yeah. Well, and just to go back to that shoe moment, it was so much fun. That press conference in, I think it was in Baghdad, right? Where a journalist from Iraq threw a shoe.
Bush was ready to go. He was ready to take him down.
I love that. See, I was a Bush critic at that time. I hated the war. I thought it was absolutely badly misinformed. It was just a dumb war. But watching Bush deftly duck a thrown shoe.
Three. It Three. Was rapid fire, and he went like this, and then he kind of was like,
yeah,
he's ready to go. He's like, what's up?
Yeah, he got a silverback gorilla thing on there.
But the other thing I'll say is Bush throwing the pitch after 9/11 at the Yankee game. I just want people to watch that video and say, okay, I disagreed with him on this policy or that policy, and I don't like the Bushes, their establishment, or whatever dumb stuff people go to bed telling themselves. This dude threw a pitch right down the middle.
He's good.
Held it, had it cocked right, came back, and Obama went out with mom jeans.
He did.
And I think that it wasn't good. Wasn't good.
Better basketball player from what I hear, Obama.
Yeah, I haven't liked what I saw.
So it's interesting that Bush was so intuitively good as a politician, I think. Like, there was the moment when he was at ground zero again. You know, we were all just, I think accurately when I say we all were upset about 9/11, and Bush grabs the megaphone and, you know, says, I'm going to make sure I hear you, and I'm going to make sure the folks over there hear you. There's just something intuitive about that that is impossible to teach. It was honest. It was authentic. And there's something wonderfully authentic about the guy. And it's fun to listen to Bill Maher say, boy, I was wrong to call him a fascist. I was wrong to call Mitt Romney a fascist. Trump, he's a fascist. Give it 10 years. You'll find a Democrat. SB-866, I want to move through these real quickly. This is the one you might remember. This is minor vaccine consent, and that is the vaccines aren't minor. It's the people who can give consent. Wiener, again, wanted to allow... He wanted to drop the minimum age for consent to a vaccine to 12. It's now, he has amended it, it's 15. But the idea was that he was going to allow kids to walk in anywhere and get any vaccine they wanted at school, as young as 12 years old. And as I say, it's now been amended to 15. That's likely to pass, so that you will have 15-year-olds able to get vaccines without
specifically the COVID vaccine?
Any vaccine.
Yeah.
Any vaccine. So you could have kids who are 15 being pressured into getting vaccines. We saw some of this during COVID where kids would show up at school and be told, hey, if you get a vaccine, we'll give you some free pizza or something. Kids don't always know what they're allergic to. They don't always know why their parents have misgivings about a particular vaccine. And I've met plenty of parents during COVID who said, hey, I'm vaccinated, but my kid can't handle a vaccine. And
Does the kid need a doctor's note?
No. No, you just go and you just get a vaccine.
Their whole thing was like this between the person and their doctor.
Well, now it's between you and your school district or anybody else who can deliver a
vaccine. This is between you and your art teacher. Like, what? Like, you're 15 now. You're ready for this.
Yeah.
Has anyone else advised you on it? Oh, yeah, my PE coach was just telling me of it. I mean, this is so stupid.
So that's still in play. Another Scott Wiener here, SB 57. I had somebody ask me yesterday what SB and AB mean. So just, you know, for those who are lagging behind, Senate bill or Assembly bill. So Senate bill 57, supervised injection sites. David, we've talked
about... I'm actually non-binary, so I don't really care about that. I go either way on that. SB, AB.
ACDC. Yep. So, David, we've talked a lot about the moral hazard of supervised drug injection sites. Can you just summarize it for us and why we hate it? And I'll acknowledge that it's still in play.
Yeah, why I hate it is I believe that we should not do things that we don't like, and we should do the things we do like. Let me say that again. So if we don't like drug abuse, I think we should not do it.
Don't encourage it.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Following so far. Continue.
And then if what we like is agency and responsibility and public health, personal well-being, spiritual fulfillment, a life of gratitude and meaning, if you like that, we should do that. So then giving people needles to put soul-crushing addictive drugs in their body, I would be against it.
You would be.
Yeah, for both reasons of commission and omission.
It seems really strange.
We're going to have to type that up in the show notes, because that's some heavy-duty moral philosophy.
It's metaphysics
right
beyond me. Its supporters say, well, you know, when they are criticized, the supporters say, well, no, this won't stop drug addiction. It'll just stop people from dying from an overdose, because there'll be somebody there to immediately, you know, use some sort of life-saving measure to support the person who has overdosed. So it won't. Not only will it not stop drug abuse, it won't stop overdoses. It'll just stop overdose deaths.
And by the way, you know, that to the extent there are people that, like, if they were to stop right away, which is untrue of alcohol and a lot of amphetamines and barbiturates, but it is absolutely true of opiates. They cannot just stop cold turkey. But in a detox and rehab program, they can legally and medically use things to wean them off of
the
opiate.
Right.
So if what we were saying was we want them to stop and we want them to do it safely, that's going to involve some more ongoing use of narcotic, we do that now.
Yes.
They're not doing anything to stop people from taking heroin.
No.
There's not part of this deal.
The medical term that I learned within the last year is titration, or to titrate, to get somebody off these drugs by slowly reducing their reliance on them. We're not doing that. We're not talking about that. One of my favorite quotes in the story that I'll put in the show notes is from...
And you know, one of the... I just want to point out, I haven't seen this marketing in California. The bill has been there, and they've been doing the San Francisco, and now there's a statewide thing that we're talking about. But there's posters up in New York about, like, the nobility. The greatest thing you can do today is use heroin safely. No, I'm being serious.
Seriously.
Yeah. Oh. It's a state-sanctioned marketing campaign.
Oh, my Lord. So there's a quote in the story from one of the bill's supporters, Laura Thomas, who's director of HIV and harm reduction policy at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. They are co-sponsors of the bill. She says, you know, they did some polling, and they found out that overwhelmingly people would prefer to use drugs in a clean space. No one wants to be using drugs in the sidewalk. If we give people a better option, they'll use it. She was referring to 602 injection users in San Francisco showed 85% would use a supervised injection site. 75% said they'd use them at least 3 times a week. Mm. It's like, I thought 100% of them would have said, if you give me the drugs for free, I will use it 100% of the time. So there's that one. And then we've got this is one of the most nefarious. Connie Leyva of Pomona has Senate Bill 1343. This would require charter schools in California to participate in the state's pension system. So if you run a charter school in California, you have teachers. One of the reasons for your success is typically that your teachers aren't unionized. So you can actually hire, fire, promote, demote, discipline teachers based on performance. It's a really weird concept in America, but we use it widely in sports. It's called merit. And so charter schools can get by without unionizing their members. So Leyva's proposal would say, okay, you got away with that, but we're going to force you to contribute cash, and for your employees to contribute cash, into a state pension system, CalPERS, CalSTRS. So this is a way of...
But then they also receive the benefit, and they run an unfunded liability. So I bet unions will oppose it. Unless it's just a backdoor gimmick to try to squash charters, they're going to add to their unfunded liability by putting more members in the program.
Oh, they will. But who's on the hook for the unfunded liability?
Yeah.
We are.
Right. But why would these people want the enemy benefiting from their scheme.
Because they, exactly as you said, the goal here is to swamp charter schools. Yeah, charter schools already, so they get tax dollars, but they get them at a discount. So they don't get the entire amount that a union-run school would get right
next
door.
But I love the pretext is that this is to give these teachers the same retirement opportunities as other employees. Regardless of they teach, they all deserve a defined benefit system that improves the quality of life when they retire. I didn't know that was part of the deal. Mm. We all deserve,
an
improved quality of life when we retire.
That's right.
I'm anticipating my quality of life going way down when I retire.
Yes.
I love my quality of life right now. How's it going to get better when I retire? I don't know what that means.
Well, did you see in the same story? It goes on. I threw it on the side over
here. But it
here
says, without CalSTRS or CalPERS, charter school teachers are left with retirement options that depend much on the stock market.
Yes!
Well, what?
Does she know that CalPERS and CalSTRS make their money by investing it in the stock market?
I don't think she meant what she thought she
No. said. Yeah. I don't think that word means what you think it means. Okay.
But it is being done as if the teacher couldn't churn down. Like, I don't want to work at a charter school because I don't like my retirement options, and I have better retirement options at the traditional public school. Why is the choice of the teacher not respected?
Because you are not an individual with any kind of agency, and you need their protection. It's a racket, man.
Is this going to pass?
Yes, very likely. David, I want to move on real quick. I'm going to skip the next two bills, if that's okay, because we've got literally like 2 minutes here, and I want to talk. I want to give you a moment to talk about USC's new student body right collective. I was so excited when I saw the story about USC creating something called student body right, knowing that it was a play on the football play. Which is a pitch out, and you pull guards and you run hard at the defense on the edge. It's actually, David, why don't you go ahead and describe it, and then I'm really eager to hear your take on this thing.
Well, no, I don't have a big take. I think I'm with the coach on this, so we kind of got to see how it goes. But we're one school, and there's a lot of other schools that are organizing efforts to execute in the new environment where monies and nonprofits and jobs and things can be raised and harnessed for students coming in. And so we've finally gotten rid, for the most part, of this absurd pretense that the adult students are to be treated like unpaid amateurs, mm-hmm. and the coaches, administrators, and directors and bureaucrats are to be paid like seven-figure celebrities.
Right.
So they have now attempted some element of eliminating that absolutely egregious economic injustice, but they're doing it through allowing the attempts of alumni to go create job opportunities and whatnot. And this is just a different effort. And I think that you're going to have a great community of people out of SC with a lot of opportunities they can put together. Most competitive schools are going to do something very similar, already have. But I think that this is just a little unique because it seems to be going a little bit outside of the direct oversight of the university.
Well, yeah, and also it's different because USC's own bespoke program is subject to Title IX. And that would mean that, money has to be given equitably, no matter whether you're a huge revenue generator like USC's football team, or I'm just making this up, I don't know, the men's squash team or something, which, nobody attends as a spectator. Maybe your family does. No offense if there's a USC squash team. But the idea of that kind of equity, quote unquote, is absurd on its face. It's the football team and the football players who put their lives on the line, who generate loads of income. And this is a program that the football boosters have set up, which is determined to send cash directly to these football players and not try to play the game of equity. So, David, that's, I think, all the time we have today. But I do want to ask people, don't hit fast forward yet, because I want to ask you to please consider this special invitation. The William F. Buckley Jr. Prize Dinner is an annual marquee event in the conservative movement created to honor the work of NR founder Bill Buckley. This year, the Institute honors the work of economist and friend of the show, Larry Kudlow, and Young Americans for Freedom. Conveniently for you, this year's event will be held right here in California at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley on September 29th. Ticket information is available on the nrinstitute.org website. That's nrinstitute.org. So join us. I think I'll be there. I'm coming back from Germany, a long story. David, I believe, will be there at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley for this joy-filled celebration of the principles and people we admire. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. Seriously, rate and review the show. We'll figure out something, David and I, here about how to reward you for rating and reviewing the show. That helps others find us and spread the good word about the saving remnant here in California. Please email us with your comments, your story suggestions. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host, David Monson, we give thanks as ever to session producers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian. And all of our friends at National Review, especially want to thank National Review podcast producer Sarah Schitte. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based Mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.